this week has been kind of a hurricane of news, so it's possible that you might have missed the resignation of the census director. I know this might seem a little academic, but stick with me. John Thompson has been the director for 4 years, and the Bureau is getting ready to count all of us in 2020. But here's the thing. The money Congress has allocated and what the census says it might actually take to do the job are two very different numbers. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. The reason this is important is because so much of our economic life depends on accurate numbers that start with the census. Stuff like healthcare, infrastructure, all sorts of government representation and funding. And those are the things we are talking about on the show today. As always, come share your thoughts with us. Email us at weekend@marketplace.org or follow us on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. So about infrastructure, the old adage is pretty simple, right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But if you think about America's infrastructure, roads, rail, bridges, airports, and hospitals, this stuff is not exactly shiny and new. About 9% of America's bridges, for example, are structurally deficient. That's from the American Society of Civil Engineers. And yeah, they have a vested stake in changing things. But so do a lot of you, who wrote to us to share what's broken where you live.
Roads! Potholes are everywhere, and no one wants to be the government that increases taxes to pay for them.
Public transport in L.A. is shameful.
Milwaukee does a great job taking care of most things, better than most places I've lived. Although the secret may have been dumping all the problems in a neighborhood that isn't mine.
Metro North train bridges in Connecticut. Norwalk is a drawbridge and often gets stuck open. You can imagine the mess that causes.
Those were Marketplace staffers voicing the thoughts of Benjamin Morris, Allison Hurd, Michael Tidrick, and Paul DeGennaro. So today and in the coming weeks, this is what we're talking about. What happens when key parts of America's infrastructure fall apart? How does it affect our everyday lives, and who benefits when things change? President Trump has floated proposals to pump $1 trillion into infrastructure projects. But when it comes to prioritizing what should be repaired or built from scratch, how are those decisions made? There's a lot of money at stake, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, when I was recently in Los Angeles, I went to visit one project that is supposed to improve mass transit there and make driving in L.A. a little less awful. You're going to hear me and Rick Jagger. He works for the L.A. Metro. Where are we standing? What are we looking at?
We're standing at Broadway and 2nd. This will be the future station site of the Broadway and 2nd regional connector. What the regional connector does is connect the region because we have lines that operate from Azusa and Pasadena into the downtown area. We have lines that operate from Long Beach and Santa Monica into the downtown area. But right now, people have to get off those lines and transfer to the subway system, and then reconnect to their lines.
How much does all this cost, and where does the money come from?
We have a full funding grant agreement with the federal government. They've chipped in about $640 million for the project and have given us a $160 million loan. And the rest of the money comes from the state and local. This is a Measure R-funded program. Measure R was a half-cent sales tax that was approved by the voters back in 2008. So this project is being funded by that. And we've leveraged those local dollars to get the federal government to participate in their share of the project.
You guys are about 28% over budget. What happened?
We ran into a lot of unknown utility work. For this project being built in probably the oldest part of downtown L.A., there were a lot of uncharted utilities that we ran into, and that became a real nightmare for us. So what we did, what the board did last year was kind of right-price the project and increase the budget, and now the life of project is the $1.75 billion, and we're fairly confident that we'll finish the project on that budget.
You know, one of the things when I look at the numbers, right, so metro ridership is up. On the rails, but overall, you're not really making a dent with the buses or taking traffic off the roads. Should people think, oh, this actually is going to make a difference in, say, traffic and, you know, sitting on the freeways for an hour or so?
Absolutely. What we're doing is building for the next 100 years, for the next generation. We've got another 2.3 million people coming to L.A. over the next 40 years. And if we sit back and twiddle our thumbs and don't do anything, yeah, we'll all be choked in our own traffic.
You know, we are in this sort of national conversation about infrastructure, right? The president's talked about it. Democrats have talked about it. You guys are actually doing it. Why do you think it is so hard to make substantial infrastructure improvements?
I think what you have to do is build community consensus. You have to get the people on board that where you're going to place the rail system, where you're going to place the lines, appeases to those people, and you have that public support, then you can do anything.
Rick Jagger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that's one infrastructure project that's getting federal money. We're going to zoom out a bit. President Trump has repeatedly talked about investing in infrastructure. Indeed, he and his administration have asked states what projects they have that are shovel-ready and need funding. But not all of that information has been in one place until now. Our colleagues at APM Reports, which is American Public Media's investigative unit, created a database of all these requests. Tom Scheck is one of the reporters behind the project. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Tom, you and your colleagues spent about 5 months digging into this data on infrastructure projects across the country. What did you find?
Well, we were interested to figure out how states were dealing with the Trump administration and the election of President Trump in November. And what we started to find was that several states, when we did open records requests of them, were really being queried by the Trump transition team about what their priorities were for infrastructure. And so we went from there and started to say, well, we should ask other governors about what they're putting on their wish lists as well. We also asked the National Governors Association, which was collecting this information, to give us the list. They declined to give us the list, and so did some other governors. So what we decided to do was start doing more open records requests saying this is public information, it's a public project dealing with taxpayer money. And so at that point, we decided, well, let's just build this list ourselves.
You know, we've been asking our audience about kind of the things that they see every day that are infrastructure projects that they want to be funded or changed. What kind of stuff is showing up in your database?
Well, a lot of the projects submitted by the governors focus on road and bridge projects. There are also requests for transit, like the regional connector project that you just visited. Rural broadband seems to be this big issue for governors as well. 12 states made that request. And then the other thing that we have isn't this isn't just a list from governors. We also included priorities from infrastructure consultants, union leaders, and others who the White House reached out to say, give us your lists. And that's where you start to see a lot of these private projects, oil and gas projects, high voltage transmission lines that carry wind energy from the middle of the country to the coasts. And then there's also other projects that deal with water, private water, in terms of like delivering water from the Mojave Desert to Los Angeles. That's a private firm that's pushing that. Some of these projects are controversial. The private investors are saying, you know, all we need is a few regulatory hurdles to be cleared that the president can do. And that in turn will then boost job creation and improve infrastructure.
Well, we're talking about, you know, potentially $1 trillion here. Where does all of this money come from?
Well, $1 trillion to you and me may be different than what they're talking about. The president himself during the campaign, he was saying he wants to create $137 billion in tax credits for developers who then invest in public infrastructure. And what they're arguing is that's going to be $1 trillion over 15 years. Now, the president has said other things too. Recently, he said he was considering a gas tax. They walked it back and said, well, he was asked to consider it. That's why he's considering it. But he also said that he's willing to invest with public money, which is something a lot of Democrats are saying has to be done. The other thing that he's really, really pushing is private investment. He thinks that you can accelerate a lot of these projects through private investment, but there's also pitfalls in that as well.
On that front, there have been concerns about public-private partnerships. Tell us about that.
The first thing is that private firms may be willing to build a new road or a building, but they're going to want something back. They're going to want tolls. They're going to want fees. The other thing is that this is controversial in the public in terms of privatization of public infrastructure. I was at an infrastructure conference last month, and a consultant acknowledged it's so unpopular. He even told the audience to not call it privatization and instead call it asset recycling. And the biggest concern here is that also that they want to do something in terms of focus on needier projects. And they're worried that investors are going to be looking at the biggest bang for their buck, right? So low-income communities, low-population communities aren't going to deliver the same bang for the buck. And then those projects that may be needy may be left out.
You know, there are more than 500 projects in your database. And I guess a question hanging out there is, how do the winners get picked? What are the Trump administration's criteria?
Well, at this point, it's not clear because the Trump administration's not really saying anything publicly and haven't called us back. But speed is clearly important. The president said he wants direct funding to projects that can start within 90 days. He's clearly made jobs a clear part of this economic agenda. So he wants to know how many jobs are these projects going to create. And then the other issue is private investment. He's made that a priority. And he talked about, okay, if we spur kind of tax credits, that will spur this economic agenda. He is a real estate investor after all. So he understands a lot of these projects and how they can happen. But the big question is, how does that work outside of the private arena and in the public arena that is Congress?
Tom, infrastructure projects have a lot of money behind them. Sometimes they're transparent, sometimes they're not. Are there ethical questions about who stands to benefit from all of these projects?
Well, as you can see, the White House has obviously been pushing the ethics envelope with this president. And it's one of the things that we're going to be looking at going forward here is who's financing these projects, you know, who has financial ties to the president, who has financial ties to the infrastructure team. And that's going to be a critical question, especially when it comes to privatization, because, you know, some of these companies may be shell corporations. And I think the public's going to want to know whether anyone's benefiting from this financially.
Tom Scheck is an investigative correspondent for our sister organization, APM Reports. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
You can check out the database at marketplace.org and look for your own state. And while you're there, share details on the infrastructure problems you see every day. We want to find some of the worst problems in the U.S. and report on them. Remember, you can email us, weekend@marketplace.org, or follow us on Twitter. We're at @marketplace_WKND. If you know Marketplace, you know we love our numbers. It's kind of our signature thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Sarah.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
3.
That's the number of years until the next census count in 2020.
This week, U.S. Census Bureau Director John H. Thompson announced his resignation, which could take place as early as next month.
Recently, the Bureau has been fighting for more funding.
Thompson told a congressional committee last week the Bureau needed an additional $309 million for IT equipment.
But last year, Congress granted the Bureau $140 million less than it requested.
With a leadership vacuum looming and a tight budget, it could mean a bumpy road ahead for census data.
70.
That's the percentage of Americans that take the standard deduction on their federal income tax.
Trump's tax plan, sparse as it is, calls for doubling the standard deduction. A couple would pay no tax on their first $25,000 or so.
That's supposed to ease the burden on the middle class, but the function of the standard deduction has changed over time.
It was originally a percentage meant to make filing simpler. Then Congress changed it to a flat amount to keep low-income people off tax rolls.
Now Trump's trying to expand that benefit, but it's not yet clear how it'll affect your final tax bill.
5 to 11.
Dollars, that is. That's the going rate for a fidget spinner right now at Walmart.
If you have a school-age kid or are particularly on-trend yourself, you've probably seen these little spinning toys around, or maybe even have a couple of them.
Many of the spinners are produced for nearly nothing in Chinese factories that typically make smartphone parts.
They're selling so fast that many companies like Shenzhen LTS Technology in China have stopped other production to focus on fidget spinners.
When it comes to hot toy trends, things can get confusing fast, but at least fidget spinners, unlike hoverboards, don't seem to literally catch fire.
Last week, we looked into the shortage of home health aides, and so many of you wrote and called us about your personal experience, either as a home caregiver or as someone looking for care or whose loved one receives care. Elaine Heim is from Houston, and her son gets home health care.
I wanted to remind people that there are adult children with severe disabilities that are also needing attendant care, nursing in the home, that now live in the community. And we are also faced with that long-term services and supports that we need for our children to support them living in the home with us. But it has been daunting to try to have attendant care that could actually take care of someone who is severely disabled. And the care that he receives in a home is a much better level of care that he would receive in a nursing home or an institution. You think about the angst that you go through placing your parent or a grandmother or a beloved uncle. Think about having to face that when it's your child.
Nanette Scott called us from Tulsa. Her mother had several home health aides before she went to a nursing home. Nanette's experience looking for assistance was hard.
It was like hit and miss. You know, we could get one that would be good for several months that was on top of their job, doing what they needed to do. And then I could start seeing when they were starting to get tired or just wasn't really into it anymore. You could see it in their work. And then you had others that they were a gem that you'd be like, oh, man, I don't ever want this one to leave, you know, because, I mean, they just did everything the way you would hope or want. I would like to believe that if home health care is as important as I know it is, the pay that they're wanting to pay the kind of people that they're bringing in to be taken more seriously.
Thanks to all of you who shared your stories with us. And we're going to keep covering this issue. Indeed, about two-thirds of home health aides in the U.S. are paid through Medicaid. And we've asked representatives from the government to come on the show and talk with us about it. And if you have more to say, you can send us an email, weekend@marketplace.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. The big political news of this week, of course, President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. Meanwhile, the FBI is investigating connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. Two congressional committees are also examining Russian meddling in our election. And many congressional Democrats have called for a special prosecutor or independent counsel to look into Russia and the Trump campaign. White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders got a question about that in her briefing on Wednesday.
You said you want the Russia investigation to continue at DOJ. Would the White House oppose the appointment of a special prosecutor to continue the investigation?
We don't think it's necessary. You've got a House committee, a Senate committee, and the Department of Justice all working on this. I don't think that there's a necessary need at this point.
We wanted to dig into both the cost and the value of special investigations. They are not a new part of the political process, but they can be expensive, both literally and politically. Laura Donahue is a professor at Georgetown Law, and I asked her to give me a sense of the different flavors these kind of inquiries come in.
Previously, what we've had are called independent counsel, and that was under the Ethics in Government Act, which was introduced after the Saturday Night Massacre when Nixon ordered the prosecutor to be fired. As you will recall, the attorney general then resigned, the deputy attorney general resigned, and ultimately Congress decided in response to that to introduce legislation to make it possible for a three-judge panel to appoint somebody to look into serious matters. But the problem that came along was partly economic in terms of the costs of these special prosecutors. So over the next few decades, there were 20 different prosecutors that were appointed, and they costed a lot of money, as it turned out. So the Clinton administration was subject to five different investigations by special prosecutors, and the costs of this were just tremendous. So, as you might recall, the 4.5-year inquiry into Whitewater, and then it was expanded to include Lewinsky, came to $39.2 million.
Wow.
So, and then there are these other investigations that went into the Clinton administration, both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. There were four additional inquiries. So, together with that Starr investigation, it came to $79.3 million. And so Congress was very concerned about the cost of this, about the politics of having somebody independent kind of being able to go on witch hunts after senior administration officials. And so in 1999, they allowed those powers to lapse. And that's when we get the second kind of counsel, which is a special counsel, which the Department of Justice's regulations allow for the Attorney General to appoint somebody in a similar capacity.
you know, you were listing some of those costs, and we were just looking at the math. You mentioned, you know, $39.2 million for Whitewater. If you go back to Iran-Contra, Lawrence Walsh, the prosecutor there, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $47 million. But then there are things like the bipartisan 9/11 commission, which was created by Congress. Is there a way to judge the idea of return on investment for taxpayers of these investigations, or does that just sort of depend on where you sit politically?
So I think that's very difficult to determine because some of the issues that are at stake are not easily quantifiable, like rule of law or accumulation of power or separation of powers or corruption. You know, it's very hard to put a number on that. Certainly since the beginning.
I guess you could say rule of law is priceless.
Yeah, right. Exactly. This is what we stand for as a country. So, you know, even years and years ago, back to Ulysses S. Grant in 1875, when he appointed John Henderson to look at the whiskey ring scandal, the point of a special prosecutor was to try to get rid of corruption at the highest levels of government. It's an absolutely critical function in a democracy to be able to have somebody who's independent and outside the power structure to be able to look at this, reveal what's going on, and hold people accountable for their actions.
Who controls the purse strings in sort of these different flavors of investigations?
So in a special counsel investigation, the Attorney General has a tremendous amount of authority. The Attorney General sets the parameters of the jurisdiction. The Attorney General appoints the individual. The Attorney General can actually reject any prosecutorial recommendation or any findings of that special counsel. So it was a slightly different situation with regard to the Ethics in Government Act that previously operated and has now expired. One of the problems that we found from that is that these investigations did tend to go on for quite some time. As you mentioned before, we have there was one investigation by Lawrence Walsh on the Iran-Contra that went on for 8 years, and it came to, you know, $47.4 million. That money goes to salaries, to travel, to rent, to supplies, to private outside contractors, to the various agencies and government. And so one of the suggestions that was made in considering whether to renew the Ethics in Government Act in 1999 was whether the Congress should put a time limit on the length of these investigations that would help to cabin the amount of money spent, or even put a spending cap on these investigations. So if Congress wanted to introduce new legislation to cover a special counsel, these might be ways to get a hold of the spending and try to prevent kind of that extraordinary spending that can come with special counsel while still allowing the highest officials in the government to be held accountable for their actions.
Laura Donahue is a professor at Georgetown Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
During the 2016 election, and really in the months since, Americans have relied heavily on social media to engage with politics. Social networks have also become a go-to place to catch up on what's happening and also to organize. And things move fast. So a protest can start like this, and in a matter of months, become a record-breaking rally like the Women's March. Fundraising for and against causes and campaigns can also happen digitally. But how effective are these new kinds of networked protests? Zeynep Tufekci wrote a book about them. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your contention is that sort of social media-fueled and networked protests have kind of hit a wall. Why is that?
Well, let me say that they don't have to hit a wall, but they often do hit a wall. So what you can do these days is use digital technologies to scale up really fast and really quickly, which is great on the one hand. On the other hand, doing things the older way had the side benefit that you spent 10 years building up infrastructure just to get to the point you could hold that march. And after you held that march, that infrastructure you built was really useful in doing all sorts of other things, because a march by itself isn't magic, right? A street march, a protest, even if it's very large, it doesn't automatically get you what you want, either legislatively or some other way, right? It doesn't automatically do this. It only works to the degree it conveys some sort of threat to people in power. They think, if they can hold that march, what else can they do? These days, a big march, it's the very first step very often that a movement gets going.
Do you think digital technology also, you know, has the potential for making it easy to sort of opt out, to feel like if you've done your part with a hashtag or even showing up in person that you've, you know, done your part, period, and kind of doesn't have the same, I guess, invested impetus to move forward?
I don't think that, because I think when people want social change, if they're going online or going, you know, to a protest and they're signaling to their friends, look, this is what I believe, I think that's actually powerful.
No,
that's
so you wouldn't call that like virtue signaling?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think that's a way of expressing your beliefs and it's a way of affecting culture. The problem is what it's not good at. And just sort of affecting culture, if you don't have the other legs of that stool, right? You've got affected culture, but what about the legislative? What about electoral threats to the people in power? What about the courts? What about all the other things that successful social movements do? So a lot of movements I study, like the Arab Spring and the Gezi Park protests in Turkey or the Occupy, they got stuck on kind of the first thing they did that worked, because since they used digital technology to organize and they didn't have organizational infrastructure to make decisions, it kind of got stuck tactically frozen doing the same thing again and again.
How then do you get the teeth in this networked era? Like, what is effective?
What's effective depends on where you are, obviously. Let's take the United States. It's pretty clear that the 2018 elections are going to be crucial because the Republican Party has power at all levers, basically. A lot is going to depend on the signal the 2018 election sends in terms of what kind of capacity the challengers have built. So that would mean electoral work, that would mean primaries. Now, when I look at this, what I see, for example, take the Indivisibles, which is this movement that sprung up of ex-congressional staffers, and they're trying to organize at the congressional district level because the elections are this big turning point. If you look at their funding, I think to this date they raised $1.6 million, and most of it is from the grassroots. That's a million of it is from the grassroots. If you look at the counterpart to this, if you look at 2016 elections, just the Koch brothers alone, just them, they put in $1 billion with a B to down ballot races in the country. So what you have, I think, is this interesting imbalance in this country where the right wing movements are very infrastructure oriented. This was true for the Tea Party too. They're very organizationally oriented and they build power by investing from the local races upwards. Whereas more left-wing movements and more Democratic Party, there is very little funding and there's very little attention to this infrastructure thing. Now, there's great grassroots energy right now in the movement. They have a great narrative power. They use social media very effectively. They're out there all the time. They're getting their story out. But are they building the kind of infrastructure that you would need to effectively, you know, challenge these elections? I'm not seeing the corresponding amount of funding from the Democratic Party, left, liberal donor class at all. You know, the movement looks very strong, but if you wanted me to rate it, I would say it's 9 out of 10 narratively and 2 out of 10 when it comes to infrastructure building.
Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina and the author of Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Networked Protest. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Zeynep Tufekci is also going to be on Make Me Smart this coming week, talking about Sinclair Media's deal to buy Tribune stations and how media consolidation affects how we get or don't get news and information. Teams from the International Olympic Committee have been in Los Angeles this week, evaluating the city as a potential host for the 2024 Summer Games. Next week, they head to Paris to do the same thing. And usually, hey, getting the Olympics is a big deal.
The International Olympic Committee has awarded Olympic Games to the city of Atlanta.
Tokyo.
Athens.
But the Olympics cost a lot. And in recent years, cities have been skeptical that hosting the Games is worth it. Boston even abandoned a bid to host the 2024 Summer Games. To figure out what's going on, we called up David Walachinsky. He's the president of the International Society of Olympic Historians. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You know, if I think back to when I was little, it seemed like every city wanted to host the Olympics. Like, it was a big financial boon for them. What has happened since then?
What's happened since then is that the costs have gone up on hosting the Olympics. Back in the old days, people didn't really make a profit on the Olympics anyway, but it didn't matter because the loss wasn't much. But now it's a big deal. There's security, there's building new venues, there's this illusion in host cities that people are going to make a killing on Airbnb, renting their place, or taxis, or Lyft, or Uber, or something like that. It's not going to happen.
Why?
Because most of the people who actually attend the games already have their own transportation. And the other thing is there's just an automatic oversupply of housing for the Summer Olympics. And so it's much more difficult now.
Have any cities in recent memory done well or managed to, you know, not be in a giant financial hole after hosting a games?
Yes. Well, certainly 1984 Los Angeles was the model because there was a nice profit which was used to set up a nonprofit organization. That became the model. But since then, there's a lot of corruption, overruns. London didn't do too badly. Vancouver didn't do too badly. Sochi was unbelievably corrupt the last Winter Olympics. And yeah. The Rio de Janeiro Olympics were also incredibly corrupt. And so a lot of money was lost on both of those.
Is this an argument then to hold the games in a city like, say, London that is going to be kind of full of people anyways, as opposed to, say, something like Sochi, which is a resort town, not a hugely populous one? Or does that not even matter?
I think what you're seeing now, the two cities that are bidding for the next Summer Olympics, Los Angeles and Paris, are in very good shape. They don't really have a problem. You know, they're going to run smoothly even if they don't get the Olympics. They're not trying to prove anything. And they've already told the International Olympic Committee, shown the International Olympic Committee, that most of the venues are ready. We have a plan. Everything's fine. The big problem that the International Olympic Committee is running into has more to do with the Winter Olympics, because a lot of the venues that you build for the Winter Olympics, it's not something you're going to reuse. You know, how many times are you going to use your luge venue?
Does that mean that the future of the games then will be held in large, very established, you could say, first world cities where there's more transparency in governance, one might argue, than in other places that, you know, might benefit from having international light shined on it?
The problem that the Olympic movement is facing is that you're either going to get big, open, transparent cities or the complete opposite, which is dictatorships. And certainly we saw the last bidding for the Winter Olympics was between Beijing, China, and Almaty, Kazakhstan, both of which are dictatorships. And there you have the opposite of transparency. You have governments that couldn't care less if there's corruption, and you're never going to find out where the money went. So you get these two extremes that are now in the front lines of hosting the Olympics.
What would you do to ensure a games that doesn't have huge cost overruns, costs for the host cities, and this kind of impenetrable budget structure that can lead to corruption?
The first thing you need to know is that almost always, whatever they tell you it's going to cost, it's going to cost more. And the second thing you need to know is no matter what they say it's going to cost, the government is going to get involved because of the security concerns. The International Olympic Committee has instituted reforms where they now have benchmarks if you're a bid city, you have to go to these meetings. One is revenue, one is organization, one is your mission, and so forth. But it's still in the birth stages. So we don't really know if this is going to work in the long run.
David Walachinsky, president of the International Society of Olympic Historians. Thank you.
Thank you.
Every now and then, we check in on businesses behaving badly. This week, the honor goes to Dove, the skincare and beauty line. Although, to be fair, not too badly. Now, Dove is all about celebrating body positivity. Yay. But the brand caught some heat this week for its latest campaign, Body-Shaped Bottles. Yeah, a new ad for Dove features bottles of shower gel representing the many forms of womanhood. Petite, tall and slender, curvy, take your pick. The limited edition bottles are only available in the UK, and they're kind of on message for Dove's Real Beauty campaign. Nice thought, but the interwebs was not having it. On Twitter, there were memes, one saying, "I already have a bottle shaped like me," next to a picture of one of those bright yellow minions from Despicable Me. Then the comments, like this: "Can somebody come over and help me measure my butt so I know which Dove body wash to buy?" And then a warning for the guys from Philip Lewis at the Huffington Post: "If she asks you to pick up a Dove shampoo from the store, just know it's a trap." There's also the practical question. A pear-shaped bottle is kind of hard to pick up with soapy hands. Anyway, something to think about. All of this aside, why are people so irritated? Elizabeth Holmes has written about style and beauty for more than a decade.
The consumer response has been so heightened because the expectations are a little bit higher from a brand that, you know, has built such a big business around this idea of accepting all body types and of authenticity. Social media sort of makes everything global. And so even though it was just in the UK, it's getting a ton of attention here in the US. And so in today's world of Twitter and Instagram, you can count on something spreading much further than the market where a product is actually sold.
So A for effort, makers of Dove, but perhaps C minus for execution. But hey, on the bright side, some people in the UK may soon get silky soft skin when those bottles hit the bargain bucket. It's unlikely that Dove UK's little marketing faux pas is going to hurt their bottom line, but one business that's seeing an uptick in Europe and the US, offshore wind energy. That was the sound of diesel generators powering down on Block Island off the coast of Rhode Island. Why? Because recently, that East Coast tourist enclave switched to powering itself almost solely from offshore wind turbines. There are five of them. They each stand about 600 feet above the water. It's twice the height of the Statue of Liberty. Globally, around 15,000 megawatts of power are generated by offshore wind turbines, but just 30 megawatts come from the U.S., and all from Block Island. But many environmentalists are hoping that Block Island's efforts could be the beginning of an offshore wind power push in the U.S. Though, as Marketplace's Jed Kim explains, we're a little far behind.
It's a really tempting prospect that we'd have a really strong U.S. offshore wind industry because, according to a 2016 report from the Department of Energy, we have in our waters the potential to nearly double the amount of energy we produced in 2015. And that's with current technology. Like I said, these things are always getting bigger and better. Will we do it soon? Maybe not. I spoke with Tim Fox of Clearview Energy Partners. He says the economics don't really work at the moment for two reasons.
One, offshore wind is more expensive than onshore renewable power. And also, there's already a surplus of power in the market, suggesting that it is difficult for any new entrant to compete in the wholesale markets right now. Prices are just cheap.
You know, maybe if we were crunched for power and we really needed a lot of electricity, then we'd see a lot of interest in developing additional sources of energy. But right now, in order for it to take off, we really need to see individual states putting in mandates for offshore wind. And so far, he says, only Massachusetts has done that. New York might at some point in the near future. But yeah, it's pretty slim right now.
That was Marketplace sustainability reporter Jed Kim. It's Mother's Day weekend. Did you get your mom a card? The National Retail Federation estimates that 78% of Americans are going to buy one this Mother's Day. And the greeting card industry is no joke. It's roughly $6 to $7 billion a year. And that's good news for card makers like Rosanna Cavernmo. She runs Iron Curtain Press, a small print shop. And then there's a stationery and office supply store called Shorthand. It's in Northeast Los Angeles, and I went to visit her at her store.
Oh. Hi.
How's
hey,
going?
I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
I'm Rosanna.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
It's a small, airy space with every office item imaginable, organized by color. I asked Cavernmo to paint us a picture of the store.
Well, it's very white and clean in here. We have everything laid out very methodically. Everything is in straight lines, little piles of beautiful items that feels a little OCD, but in a nice way. Hopefully not a too stressful of a way. We have a shelf, like just walls of greeting cards.
She has stocked the shop with a mix of greeting cards from small boutique presses, as well as her own creations.
I get to choose every single card, and so everything still feels very cohesive in here because I'm choosing from other people's lines the cards that I really love the most.
And that, of course, includes this weekend's holiday.
Over here, we've got lots of cute Mother's Day cards. I'm going to get my mom the one from Hello Lucky that says, blah, 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 boyfriend, blah, blah, drama, blah, 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 money, blah, blah, talk me down, life hacks, blah, 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 good news. You get the idea. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Happy Mother's Day.
Some of the cards on that wall were made here in the back studio where Cavernmo and her team have two printing presses.
This press is from 1880.
Wow.
And I got this one 10 years ago when I first started printing, and it's been my little baby ever since.
Obviously, we had to see how it works. She ran off a letter-pressed notebook cover for us.
So it came out?
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Okay.
What was not there is now there.
Beautiful. And so that would be the notebook cover. And now that that one's out, does that mean you could then, you know, run
print
off
a whole bunch.
25 of those or whatever?
Yeah.
Doing business this way can seem incredibly old-fashioned. We are in an age where people buy things online and communicate via email and text and a million different apps. Why do they still buy greeting cards?
Yeah, and stationery and office supplies. Why do they buy any of it? And I think I was talking to my husband, Joel, this morning. We are business partners now. And he was like, well, you wouldn't send e-flowers to your mom or to your partner. Like, a card is the same. Like, you might as well not send a card if you're going to send an e-card. And there's something about like taking the time to write a note to someone, like you really have to mean it. And so you're going to choose to buy a card for it. I think it feels good to be connected to someone in that way.
How is that borne out in terms of the numbers you see in your business?
Oh man, we sell so many greeting cards. I was looking this morning and in the year that we've been open, we've sold 15,000 greeting cards, which kind of blows my mind.
Yeah.
And it ends up being, if you want to get real nerdy, it's 28% of our total sales. That's kind of fun to see. So even of our total revenue. So it's like a small dollar item, but we're selling so many of them that it makes a pretty big dent in our total sales.
Who do you think of as your competition?
You know, there aren't many stores like ours on the east side of LA. And so therefore, I don't really feel like there's much competition on this side. So I feel like it's just stores that sell a lot of greeting cards probably would be similar, but our focus is so specifically on desk items that I can't really think of many stores. I guess Staples?
Well, do you think that you're drawing people who might otherwise go pick up a card down the aisle at CVS?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably. I haven't heard anyone say that to me specifically, but I wouldn't be surprised if since now they know we exist on this street and that they can find a card because boutique greeting cards get a bad rap as being expensive.
Yeah.
But if you go to CVS, cards are $3 to $5 now. They're not, and so we're like on the slightly higher end of what you can get at CVS. It's very rare to find a card for $1.99 anymore.
Yeah. Break down for me kind of what your business is. We're in the store, we're looking at the presses, you showed me some of the cards. What else is in your business? What's the rest of that pie chart?
So we work with a lot of creative ad agencies and production companies in LA to make their like high-end printed goods. And then the other quarter of our business is our wholesale line. And so we have the greeting cards, but then we also have notebooks. And then the other half of our business has become the store. And it's incredible. Like, we certainly our wholesale and custom business has grown because of having the storefront, but the store really is its own entity. It's bananas how much business we do in 300 square feet.
I mean, that's kind of amazing. The store's only been open for a year, but in terms of your revenue, half of it comes from the store.
Yeah. And it like and the print shop is no slouch. I mean, it's been truly life-changing for us. People my age, people slightly younger, we all buy greeting cards. There's all these cheesy things about it. If you grew up around technology, you want less of it. And I think partly that's true. Like, sending a note feels so much more meaningful than a text. I'm not afraid. I think there's plenty of room to grow, but I think there's plenty of room to grow for companies that are more like mine. And the independent greeting card industry, we're probably like a small to middle-sized company even still within this small industry. And so to watch the people who are larger than me and like aspire to be more like them, but also be able to encourage the younger companies coming up behind me, it's so fun to be part of this industry.
And I actually got my mom a little something for this weekend while I was in the store. Spoiler, it is a card with a joke about mom butts. Mom, I promise I am not making fun of you. Well, I mean, not this time. I'm gonna get in trouble for this. Want to send us a card, we're cool with some digital love. Just email weekend@marketplace.org, reach out on Twitter, we're @marketplace WKND, and if you miss us during the week, subscribe to the podcast wherever you like to do that. Just look for Marketplace Weekend. And coming up next week, we check in with you on the infrastructure dramas in your neighborhood, and maybe I will tell you about my nightmare commute. Remember, send us your road, rail, broadband, and crumbling structure stories. We're all ears. This is APM.